I had the opportunity to answer in the HariMedia.net forums a very interesting text, which I was not aware was so interesting until I started to answer it. The person was asking me about, essentially, essence and form and the way in which they would interact. Of course, I'm making the subject that he explained very simplified, but that's the way I dealt with it. Now, what was interesting was not exactly the question itself, but what the question made me think about, what the question caused me to philosophically enter into. And I found that to be very interesting, because the way in which it was dealt with, the way in which I factually dealt with this situation, caused me to understand a lot more, or rather to be able to express a lot better that which I did understand, but wasn't even sure of that I did. Now, that situation is based on personality, is based on essence, is based on what we are. In fact, so much is based on this energetic point that sometimes we forget about it. For example, air. You don't really take air as having such significance to your everyday life. You don't think about air as an incredibly significant ingredient. It's as if the air itself is just accepted as the foundation of our life, and we don't consider more than that. This point of air, how do we live without it? In fact, it defines what we are. It defines what we are as people who breathe, who have lungs, who interact with air as the basis of the life that we live. Now, in a similar way that we take for granted air, although we know it's the essential part of our physiological being, we also take for granted, so to speak, or that's not really the point. The point is that the foundation and fundament of our spiritual metabolism, so to speak, it's very difficult to talk about these things, is our personality. Now, what amazed me when I was writing this text was how incredibly difficult it is to talk about these axiomatic elements of our energy, of our spiritual existence. For example, if you were to have to start, of course, this is a much more simple thing, but if you were to have to start explaining your relationship with air, it would really make you think about air, the importance of it, the value of it, the quality of it, the movement of it, the way you depend on it, and how you would feel without it. How would you describe the feeling and the necessity of the way in which the air goes through your nose and into your lungs? How would you describe the way you feel about the blood exchanging the oxygen and giving out the waste product in your lungs? How would you even be able to start to talk about that from your experience? Now, what you would end up doing would be to probably start speaking about it from the point of view of scientific understanding, or the point of view of something that you have heard. The thing is that you don't really have a direct connection to the way in which your metabolism works, the way in which the oxygen exchange works, the way in which your blood flow works, because it is an intrinsic part of your being, the part of your physiological being. It's something that goes on in the fundamental aspects of your physiological being. So you don't really have a conscious connection to it. So when I had to start talking about essence and form and personality in relationship to consciousness, I realized a lot And I would like to try to share that with you today. Although I must admit, almost certainly I won't be able to explain it very well, but I will try. Now, one of the difficulties that people have when they speak about spiritual energy, they speak about spiritual forms, they speak about spiritual personality, is dealing with it throughout all spirit. It is one thing to speak about it in relationship to the human beings, because the human beings have a very developed form of consciousness. They can communicate. They can have philosophical discussions. They can understand concepts. So it's quite easy to understand and communicate and discuss the way in which our spiritual energy manifests. And because of that, when we speak about spiritual forms, we speak about spiritual bodies, we speak about personalities, we generally do it through the medium of the human form. It's usually the human form that can do this, the human form that can be manifest in its spiritual body, and so on. And this leads us to a discussion about the spiritual body, the creation of the spiritual body, the manifestation of the spiritual body. What is it? How does it work? How does it come about? And so on. Now, a lot of people try to avoid, or rather have their own experience of personality or individuality as being an impediment to manifesting one's essence. And when I was discussing this question, it came to mind because another person was asking about animals, how animals relate to us, how plants relate to us, the reasoning for them to be in their bodies. People speak about nowadays about how we enter into these bodies because of some choice in between lives, of some decision in between lives for advancing our evolution. And then they would question, others would question, well, why would an animal choose to be an animal? Why would for example, a single-celled animal or an amoeba choose to be so? How would this work? And then that brings up the question of how living entities would move, if they would move at all. I mean, would they move through these species of life? Would they evolve through species of life? Is there an evolution of species through to a point where one could manifest the spiritual form? Now, what would be the mechanism by which that happened? I mean, how would it be so? And would it be different for every other living entity everywhere and human beings? So then it made me start thinking, well, formerly, when following the Vedic scriptural understanding, or at least the way it was explained, we had this situation where it was the human being who manifested that choice and consciousness, and even those who are higher didn't really have a choice. Those who are lower didn't really have a choice. It was only this one particular form. Now, that sounded, when I thought about it from a detached point of view, rather convenient philosophically. I thought it was too convenient. I thought it was too easy. It explained too many things in one fell swoop. In other words, with just one understanding, you just solve so many philosophical problems that you never even have to touch. Now, believe me, I'm not against solving philosophical problems. Obviously, it's something we do with our rational minds. But I wasn't satisfied with just accepting that. So I allowed myself to enter into this discussion, which I had avoided for many years. Now, I found, like I'm sure everyone found before me, it is rather less difficult to deal with my consciousness, my essence, my personality, and those humans around me than it is to deal with any other living entity. So, okay, I started with the easy point. So it made sense when I thought about it that I am an essence. My essence is Now that's a very important point. I am. I am being. I am. So I am, and because I am, that which I am is something which I would suspect is a constant. In other words, my energy, the quality of my energy, the specific quality of my energy is a constant. As much as I would want sometimes, and as much even as I try to do when I have a one-on-one consultation with somebody, or maybe I wouldn't want to do actually, you cannot merge yourself with someone else. You cannot become someone else energetically. By my experience, now I'm talking through my experience, and others have a similar experience, but I'm now talking through my experience. I am what I am, and that unique me remains so even when I'm in the state of total identification with all that is around me, total connection with all that is around me, by allowing my energies to flow out from me. Now, some people have a problem when they speak about having connection with the all around, feeling unity with the all around, feeling oneness with the all around, and feeling that I am the one in the center of that oneness. It's something which irritates people's minds who don't accept that concept. And yet, those who have that experience, who have actually experienced that connection, that oneness with all around them, with large spaces around them, I don't want to define it, and they know it is from their center. They don't really care what you say. Arguing with them has no meaning. They will just say it's just words because they have that experience. Yet, interestingly enough, there will be one with that experience, and right next to them, perhaps even meditating in the same room, would be another with that experience. And yet, as much as they would like to philosophically think so, maybe perhaps of what they've heard, they cannot become one. The two ones don't become one. That center of the universe and this center of the universe remain unique, integrated energies who are connected with all around them. Now, perhaps this is common sense and it's an obvious thing to say. So maybe it's not such an important point, but I thought in connection with other points, this might be a very valuable point to understand. I have seen realized persons, two or more realized persons, who are unable to connect with each other. Now that is very telling, very interesting. Now I remember in the early 70s, Yogi Bhajan, very nice person, was trying to gather together all spiritualists to work together in harmony to really do something unique on the planet. And as much as all of these realized souls got together, they just could not make that kind of harmonious unification which they theoretically felt should be possible. Now, some people interpreted that to mean that these people were not really in that oneness. They were not really realized as they should be. And other people took it to mean that actually there is this absolute difference between everybody, and therefore that unification could not be made. Now, I started to think about it from another point of view. What if this idea of that integrated essence connecting with the oneness is the fundamental axiomatic truth of personality, that the oneness and difference that Lord Chaitanya spoke about manifests through our personality, The difference manifests as our personality, not as our quantity. Now, again, I must remind you, this is a very difficult concept to talk about, and I'm obviously going to stumble my way through this description, so bear with me. Now, go ahead. So now, this idea of dividing between quality and quantity, it's too simplistic. It doesn't assist us to really grasp with a realization that allows us to manifest it in a way which we really can taste it. The idea that I'm very small, the idea that there's great God, these kind of quantifications may not at all be relevant to the essential existence that we live in. When you talk about quantity, quantity is something you can measure. It's very definable. It is not a vague term. You've got 1 liter of this, or 1 cubic yard of that meter. You've got definable quantities. It is limited. It is so and so much. You can measure it. You can see it. You can weigh it. Or you can do things which will allow you to define it in some kind of volume or weight or something like that. But there are things which define quantification. And, for example, personality is something which defines quantification. Color, in its archetypical definition, defies quantification. I will get back to those things, but let us understand, for example, intelligence. When you have an intelligence test, somebody may have an IQ, for instance, of 170. Very high IQ, intelligence quota. But we have seen, not everybody, but we have seen people with incredibly high IQs who lack common sense, who lack the capacity to take care of themselves, who lack any practical capacities which other people take for granted. Sometimes one wonders why they don't have a CSQ, a common sense quotient. How you have any common sense in your life. Let's talk about a color. Because a color or a tone. Now, of course, a color or a tone, they have a frequency. A frequency is something which manifests from energy. It's a wavelength associated either with a sound or with a light vibration, which allows us to perceive it. So that is a quantifiable thing. Now, this quantifiable thing is basically only the frequency of the color. It doesn't really define the color. It's a frequency which our nervous system interprets as a color. But if you start talking about the manifestation of color on walls, then this is so many parts of this shade, so many parts of this shade mixed together makes a blend. That's a color. That's also quite quantifiable. But I'm talking about the essence of color, the archetypical color, that which is the source of these frequencies and vibrations. One could say, for instance, that no color would exist without the sun, that without the sun's light, there is no color. So some may say the sun is the source of color. Without light, there is no color. Now, of course, I'm sure some scientists have already dealt with this and given some understandings of all this, but let's take that same kind of problematic situation and move it to something esoteric, like my personality. Now you can quantify my words. You can count exactly how many words I spoke in this lecture. You can even define how long I spoke in this lecture. But you can't quantify the meaning of what I'm saying, which is the point of the words. My words are giving you, or rather the way I speak my words, or how I speak my words, or how I look when I speak my words, or the concepts that make you feel the way you do, this gives you a connection to my personality. Now, just consider that. You can quantify a lot about this communication, but none of that which you quantify really or even significantly has anything to do with this conversation. Not one of you out there could care less about how many words. Like, for example, if at the end of this lecture you got on your screen 10,432 words, you couldn't care less. And as far as the length of this, you would only care if you had to go to the bathroom or do something else. Otherwise, if it's interesting, you don't care. And if it's boring, then you start to care about how long it is. So the most important aspect of this lecture defies quantification. Unless you were to take a vote. Let's say there's 500 people listening to this lecture, which is not unreasonable. So if you were then to say, let's take a vote. How many people thought it was very good? How many people thought it was good? How many people thought it was bad? How many people thought it was very bad? You would get some numbers. This would be a quantification of your opinion. But it would be a relative kind of a vote, because what you think is good, I think is very good, may be relatively quite different. If it's a scale of 1 to 10, rated on a scale of 1 to 10. Well, what I think that scale means and what you think that scale means is different. And therefore, the vote would only be a vote which would say how your personality is relating with mine in this particular interaction. Back to color. The quantification of the color blue that might be scientifically used is another kind of a number which means nothing to us. Do any of us even begin to think about the frequency of that light vibration? Do any of us even care about it, unless we are scientists of some kind? None of us think about it for any reason. We think about the way the color blue affects us. We think about the way the color blue impresses us with feelings, or gives us a mood, or creates an ambience, an atmosphere within our environment. But this is totally 100% subjective. It is completely, what we are saying is how my personality relates with that color. Now, how do you quantify that? How much it affects you? How much it makes you feel? It makes me feel a lot. Well, what does that mean? These quantifications of the essential elements of our life are useless. Remember, we're talking about the problem of qualitative oneness and quantitative difference as being an essential factor in life. I am challenging that. And that's why we're having this discussion. Now, I'm challenging that by saying the most important things defy quantification. Let's take love. How do you quantify love? Now, in my quote, in my text in the forum, I said, how would this sentence make you feel? I love you, my dear, as much as 3 buckets of tomatoes. Now, that kind of quantification is something which has no meaning. And yet, I said, I love you as much as the sky is blue. I love you as much as the sun is bright. Also, has no meaning. Yet, it properly displays how I feel, and the person who hears it will understand it in the similar way. I love you as much as the sky is blue is meaningless because the sky is not really blue at all. the sky is just seeming to be blue due to the interaction of the light from space hitting our atmosphere. We only see the blue sky when we're on this side of the atmosphere, looking up. When you're on the other side, looking down, it doesn't look blue at all. It doesn't look like anything. But if I were to say, I love you as much as the sky is blue, everyone would understand it. Everyone would empathize with it. Everyone would appreciate it. That love is essence. That love is my essence. Yet it is impossible to quantify love. How much is there? How do you quantify it? With what terms would you quantify it? So what you have to do is forced to create a relativity. Let's go to the real essence here. Let's say we've got us who are spiritual beings. And then you've got God, who's also a spiritual being. So the real way you deal with it is to say, well, God is obviously bigger than me, greater than me. Whatever that grade is, you just give any quality, give any understanding, any characteristic, and God is greater than me. Therefore, God is great, and I'm not so great. Let's call me little. Let's call me small. But these concepts, they don't really mean anything. The relative difference of great and not so great, whether you call me small or you call me insignificant or somebody else calls me great, these are all just relative, vague, and meaningless terms. We don't walk around all day quantifying ourselves in relationships to others. We quantify only things which can be measured. You cannot measure yourself in relationship to others, although we try to do so. We try to measure ourselves in relation. That person's very, very much better than me. I'm not so good. How often are we correct? Okay, let's take this concept of quantification and throw it away, because it's not a very good concept. It's a concept which is simply going to get us in trouble. It's a concept that we can't deal with. It's a concept which is impossible to use in our life in an important and valuable manner. And let's just go to the point which we really know to be true, which is important to us. The non-quantifiable personality, the non-quantifiable energy that I am, the love that I am, the spirit that I am, that energy that I am. And the real difference between us is not the size. It's not even between us and the Supreme. It's not the size. It's the personality. Really, if you want to say it right, the divine, the Supreme God, however you want to say it, is this wonderful, very powerful personality. And we are other personalities. That's all you can say. Now, what is it about our personality that is so special? I would like to propose that which is special about our personality is the uniqueness of it. I met, as I said the other day, a ISKCON guru, and everybody had been telling me how much this person has changed, how much this person has transformed, how much this person has evolved. And from my point of view, this was the exact same person I knew. No different. Now, I wouldn't want to say that to others because they would think that's an insult. But I don't recognize how far forward this person has moved, or how really this person has made great strides in his life and so on. But that's not at all what I mean. I understood something about the way I perceive people, and I thought that was very good for me to perceive, because I actually was only perceiving the personality, not the manifestations of it. I could forgive errors. I could overlook defects. I could understand the stage of evolution. But it was the personality that made me wish to interact I wanted to do it at all. Now, this is a very, very important point for relationships, for husbands and wives, for friends, for any relationship there is, because it's the essence of relationship, of this archetypical concept called relationship. Because all of us, depending on our capacities, can forgive mistakes, can overlook defects, can deal with almost anything which is imperfect in others, because we are so imperfect ourselves, and we understand that in others. Yet, without the attraction and desire to connect to and find out more about and interact with the personality of another energy, we won't do it. Doesn't matter how rich you are, doesn't matter how smart you are, doesn't matter how beautiful you are, doesn't matter anything you are. If your personality is just not acceptable, you cannot continue the interaction. Look at Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. Two huge stars who are themselves institutions, who are beautiful beyond belief, successful beyond belief, rich beyond belief, who can speak and do things and are just great people, and they divorce. They have this personality difficulty. All the other stuff was meaningless to them. It was the personality, the essence of what they were, that didn't work. Now, I must warn you, there is one big monster thunderstorm about to happen here. And if it happens and our electricity gets cut off, even for a millisecond, my audio interfaces are not on the electricity. So I will have to start everything again. So you're going to be cut off for a little while. Just be patient if that happens. Now, let's just consider this non-quantifiable energy that we are. It is something you just can't modify. Now, I want to explain that. Now, it's kind of obvious you can modify all things about you to a certain extent. If you're fat, you can be skinny. If you're skinny, you can be fat. If you're stupid, you could practice using your intelligence. If you're careless, you can become careful. Certain things you can modify, sure. But what you are not only can't be modified, but shouldn't be modified. Can you imagine if you could modify what you were and you were in a relationship? One day your wife or husband would wake up and say, "Who are you?" Naturally, when we come down to, or rather we clarify all the obstacles to simply being what we are without having to be disturbed by the external around us, we don't really have a problem with being what we are. It's only when we're interacting that these problems might be there. Let's get to the real point, the spiritual body, which is supposed to be the title of this lecture. I knew it would ramble to the point at one point, but let's get to that point. Let's make a theoretical scenario. Let's create a scenario, because I think it would be very, very valuable for us to understand the situations of our spirit. And believe it or not, this scenario would help us understand the situation of single-celled animals, of plants, of all creatures everywhere. And it also directly addresses the chicken and egg syndrome of whether one starts off as completely unencumbered spirit or one is eternally what one is within the material, so to speak, realm. Now, I don't mean to say we're going to answer all the questions, but at least we're going to get some possibility to understand more deeply that which is of the most important to all of us, that spiritual form. Now, we don't have to talk about spirit. We know what it is. It's our essence. It's our energy. But form is something which we should discuss for a very short time. It's an important point. Now, if you think of form as a certain kind of a measurable thing according to our certain, some of our senses, you'll have a hard time with this discussion. For example, the form of a notebook or something like that, this compact size and shape, which everybody can look at and agree this is a notebook. Now, how did this notebook assemble? This notebook assembled because somebody had a desire to write in notebooks. So somebody thought it's a good way to make money to create notebooks. So the assembly of this notebook came through somebody's desire and then manifested as a product because somebody had a desire to make money, supplying me a product I need because I have a desire to write in it. Now, a lot of people have trouble with form and spirit being close together because as far as they understand, form, by definition, is contrary to spirit because form is something definite in terms of a physical reality and spirit is something indefinite in terms of energetic reality. Now, there's another form of the energy which is a little bit different. For example, sound vibration is also energy. It's also a form. But the vibration itself is a form that can only be seen in terms of the way it interacts with a measuring device. Or the color, the frequency, in terms of the way it interacts with a measuring device. Or the way in which it affects me, or I consciously cause it to be created to affect you. For example, in my words. Sound is energy. Sound is part of the senses. It's part of the whole realm of existence. So I'm making a sound in a specific way to impact you. I'm assembling this energy to impact you according to my desire, which is born of thousands of factors, but I'm the one doing it. So the active factor, the most important factor of this, is my desire. In every single manifestation of my energy, my desire, which is not definable by quantification, you can say more or less desire, but that's a relative thing, is the main and most important factor. So let's just go to the theoretical model of an energetic essence, the spirit, okay? But the essence, let's call it the essence, a unique essence. Could be me, could be you, could be anybody, but just an essence. Could even be God, just an essence, existing as an essence. And let's make a model of assembling energy. Now, this is not a foreign concept. This is not something you have no experience of, because when we do our meditations, when we're very deeply in our essence, and we do things from that state of essence, we have this exact same experience. So try to remember that for a second while we're discussing this. Now, that essence, when it's in its, shall we say, totally non-manifested state, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist and it doesn't mean it's not unique. It means it has not manifested anything as a manifestation of its energy. An incredibly important point. Naturally, you will be perhaps saying that, hey, these points have been discussed in literatures. I mean, the non-manifested state becoming manifested, the uniqueness of the creation and all that. And yet, what I'm trying to do is explain it in a way which will bring it under our conscious control. Let's just talk about that non-quote-unquote manifested state, which is simply the state of rest. Let's not call it a non-manifestation. Let's call it a state of rest, a state of essence, the state of being. Now, you can feel that. You have experience of that. You have attained that during your meditations. And how long you stay in that state of being, well, that just simply depends on your desire, doesn't it? You might think, oh, I couldn't maintain the state. But I might think you no longer needed to be in that state. You no longer wanted to be in that state for the reason of your desire from that state of being. You could choose to say it's your defect that you can't stay in it, or you could see it for what it is. You no longer see that you should, because you were there. And when you're in the state of being, only your being will take you out of that state. This is so incredibly important. I don't know how to emphasize it enough. Sometimes people think, well, it was the noise or the disturbance or the interruption which made me feel like that. Yet those noises, disturbances, and interruptions were there while you were going into that state of being. But because of the, shall we say, interest you had to enter into that state of being, you ignored them. And when you were in that state of being, and for some reason or another, you chose to be disturbed by them and use it as an excuse to come out of that state. Perhaps it was a feeling of boredom, perhaps a feeling of urgency. I don't know. But the essential point of this is the choice to come out, the choice to now come out. And what do you do when you come out? You manifest. What does it mean? You come out, you choose to come out of the state of rest and then enter into a state of action. Now, when one is in that state of being, and one, let's take the theoretical point again. There is no encumbering externality. There's no physical body. There's no physical atmosphere. There's the state of being. And one is in it, and desire arises to act. To, what does act mean? It means to have the energy flow from the state of being, to flow anywhere. And that energy flows according to the particular form of our personality. It is our personality, our unique individual personality, the unique makeup of our being, which directs the flow, or which is the way in which the flow will take place. My unique personality is the reason, it's not really a cause, rather it's just the manifestation. The flow manifests in the way, only the way it can flow, the only way it can flow, according to what I am. It is not that it will flow in the way you are, or the flow in another way, somewhere over there, or we can decide to flow it this way or that way. It has its nature, and its nature is so because of its uniqueness as that center of consciousness, that personality. So what is the personality? It is the, basically, the way we think of it, the sum total of how our being will expand into that other state that is different from the state of rest. Now, someone may think the way that has manifested, the way that has moved from rest into that state of not at rest, because I don't want to define it, could be wrong. Where would it, or how would it, or what would it be? Well, let's talk about it from the point of view of what we might consider the optimal manifestation of it, the creation of, or the assembling of, or the allowing of our energy to manifest, to assemble the spiritual form. So what it is will manifest. Let's say the desire is to speak, or the desire is to see, or the desire is to feel a contact with another being. So one would have to assemble the form in such a fashion to facilitate the relationship, the interaction. But the form itself would not be the personality. It would be the expression the personality has chosen to take to manifest the tool, the vehicle through which the energy will flow to fulfill the desires. Let's just take for a wild example. Let's say the being has a proximity to a being which seems to have the form of a male that attracts us. And that attractive force creates desire in their state of rest to flow towards the attractive force with the energy. Now, in some cases, the state of rest will flow in that state of rest towards the attractive force and remain with it, if that would be satisfying to the desire of the being in the state of rest. Let's say the attractive force brings us together and my personality manifests. That means my desire is there. Yes, I feel the attractive force. I want to interact with it. How shall I interact? I shall interact according to my personality, because that's all there is. All of those features of me, how I would manifest speech, how I would manifest hearing, how I would manifest sight, how I would manifest feeling. These things would naturally assemble, my senses would assemble as the means through which my consciousness would interact with that which I am attracted to. This is a universal principle. Now, my personality is now allowing the flow of communications, of in and out, to the essence, the energy is flowing in and out. And in that flow of in and out, it defines a relationship which is natural within that flow. But wait, if there's seeing, there has to be something to see. Now, I'm not saying this is the creative process. I'm trying to take something which is a homogeneous energetic essence, which is manifested instantly, and trying to explain the way it could create. Not create, could manifest. Now, the attraction is a given. There's already the attraction. That means my personality, the other's personality, have connection and are attracted. There is a reason for that attraction. The reason for that attraction is the essences that we are. So the essences are, I am seeing and being attracted. I am hearing and being attracted. I'm feeling and being attracted. That which I am attracted to has the exact same experience. So it is the form, the entirety, the form, the whole manifestation, including that so-called what is seen, that energetic form, which is part of the attractive feature. And just, you have to make this understanding complete. I'm not going to try to do it in words because it's not possible. It's just the form of our personality when the desire so manifests is. I cannot explain it. It is. It is there. It is. It is that form which is attracted to the other form, which is. It is the nature of what we are. Our forms, our vision, sight, sound, hearing, all that vehicle which takes place is. That is the spiritual form. It is not something you create. It is not something that is created for you. It is what you are. And naturally, as you would expect, if the attractive personality is the supreme, all of the energies that are at rest would manifest their attraction to the supreme according to the form they are, of the personalities they are, wherever it may be, and in whatever way it may be, with the infinite variety of possibilities of connection with the supreme. And therefore, absolutely, there is no better or worse in this. Because every single being everywhere is being what it is in relationship with the Supreme, because that's what it's the only thing it can be, because that's what it is. We are this unique personality. And these unique beings that we are have a unique situation in existence. And we manifest uniquely what we are. And that is what differentiates us. It is not a quantitative difference. It is the unique difference of what we are. That is not a difference. That is the impetus for the oneness of connection. I don't know. Maybe you think this is, yeah, we've heard it before in another form, but I thought it would be very interesting to approach this situation from the point of view of our unique being to empower us to attain that which is ordinarily thought to be a very difficult process of attainment. I was almost feeling when I was speaking all that, that I was touching upon the essential secret which gives us entrance, which empowers our acceptance of what we are in relationship with that all-attractive personality. Of course, it also includes multiple connections. For example, those who understand that all-attractive feature to be Radha and Krishna would want to associate with Radha. So her girlfriends are best suited for that. So they have that form to associate with her, which also attracts Krishna because he's attracted to her girlfriends. So we have this situation where Radha sees, Krishna as the most attractive personality. I think we're breaking open the heavens with this discussion. And all of us feel that connection to Radha. So that manifestation of our personality, which comes from that attractive feature, fits, because we have our own girlfriends too, perfectly within existence. Now, I got a question from St. Petersburg, which I think is very important to answer, because it will allow me to expand this topic in a way, I think, which will give us a clearer conception of what I was trying to get at. And don't forget, in the very beginning I said this was going to be a very difficult discussion. It's a very subtle point, and I'm going to stumble my way through it. So I fulfilled my promise. Now, this question begins with the phrase, and even though it's, of course, not necessarily, it's not the whole question, it's just the beginning of the question begins with this phrase, and I want to talk about this phrase. It begins with, after we get a form according to our desire. I want to discuss that. Now, this phrase, I know, is born of the discussion we were having, especially at the end, but it does not reflect the reality of the situation. Now, I know that when I was speaking, I spoke about assemble a form or manifest a form and so on. These were just attempts to try to paint the picture of the whole concept at once, and naturally, it was an incomplete attempt. Now, maybe the trustin wasn't translated properly, or maybe the choice of words was not what the person meant, but I think it's important I just clarify, you don't get a form. Your energy is in a form already according to what you are. And according to how that energy manifests, I know that's a horrible word to use, it's not the best word, but according to how that energy flows, in an interaction, it will have a form. It is the interaction. It is the relationship that creates a particular appearance of what you are. This is the most interesting part of spiritual relationship. In other words, no one sees us as we are as a whole. Everyone sees us in the interaction we have with them. And how form is perceived is very much related to the person who's perceiving it. You must have heard the statement, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's kind of like that. Form is in the energy of the beholder. Now, I understand this is a troublesome thing to deal with unless you already understand it. So I'm having a very hard time expressing it. But in essence, what I'm saying is, you are that which your energy is, manifests in relationship and in the interaction with that which you relate to. So let's say you are relating to, for example, Krishna. Just for example. Then that which you are will manifest perfectly, so to speak, or will be expressed in relationship to Krishna. Whereas when it is manifest in relationship to another person, it will be transformed or the appearance of it will be a subset of what you are that is in relationship to who you are relating. Here's an example. My mother has a form which manifests quite differently to my father than it does to me, her son. If you understand that, you understand what I'm talking about. In other words, and I think this is very specifically one of the most important points we can understand, that our energy, what we are, how we express ourselves, is very much a factor of our desire to express in relationship with other personalities, whoever they may be. So it is not a question of getting a form. It is a question of that form coming into a situation where it can express itself in whatever way required to connect to the desired personality. So they're asking, I'll skip the getta form. When we are manifesting according to our desires forms, is it possible to consider that we divide ourselves into conscious parts, and one of our parts remains in clean existence and the other comes into this world? Now, this question is a very important point to discuss. And why it's so important is because it brings up elements that I very much want to touch upon. And this is very connected to the discussion which has to take place about forms of single-celled animals or forms of trees or plants or animals or other non-human forms. Now, it is assumed by most spiritualists that we are all equal. And that assumption carries with it a certain kind of a quantitative feeling to it. Now, I know that's not an absolute statement for all people, but there's a certain kind of quantitative feeling of equality amongst spiritual beings. Usually this is accepted as an axiomatic principle. Okay, I have to deal with this, otherwise our house will be torn up into little pieces. You're going to have to see. Now, this need to quantify things is also related to our need to understand things. Because when we can measure things, when we can analyze things in terms such as this much of that and this much of this, we can understand better the interaction between things. But if we were to question this axiomatic, it seems to be an axiomatic truth, understood by many, many spiritualists all over the world, that everybody is equal in quantity, we might find that this is not necessarily so. For example, if you are to think about those who have very great power, or those who have the capacity to manifest themselves in multiple, shall we say, expressions of so-called a living being, expressions of a unique living being at the same time, this would bring into question the quantitative equality of all souls. So you would then end up with having to describe those who have that extra power, so to speak, as being somehow or another a form or an incarnation, avatar, expansion, and so on, of the Supreme, and everybody else, therefore, of another category, a living entity, who are absolutely equal. Now that works, I mean, as far as an explanation, as far as a philosophical concept that makes sense, is consistent, is enabling us to deal with realities of manifestations of personalities, it makes sense. It may not be the best philosophical vehicle to explain it, but it certainly is a workable one. Now let's consider the case of a personality who may be in two places at the same time. This we've read in various literatures of religious traditions, or we can understand it in terms of advanced devas or personalities like this, or even we might even extend it to a personality having connection in the spiritual realm or in the material realm, if you wish to use those phrases at the same time. If you say that there is a limit to the power of a personality, which I suppose is a reasonable thing to say. However, for those who have the capacity to be in two or more places at the same time, they must have had a larger source of power to begin with, so that they may function in both places as normal personalities. The question would be whether that attainment of a greater power, which is now different in quantity than a smaller power, which is called a living entity, is inherent, which means it's always there, or the power may grow or reduce. But at the same time, if we speak about the being as what we are, what would be the source of increase of being, or what would be the cause of reduction of being? Or would being only increase and never decrease, as some people think? And if being would increase, where would that increase come from? Would it come from an ever-increasing storehouse of being, or would it reduce someone else's being? Or if the storehouse of being or energy is increasing, then does it go to more being in its own particular way, or would it fill up other beings and increase more beings? I can't answer these questions, not from my experience, not from my realization. It's way beyond my capacity. We are talking about the highest understanding of cosmic reality on realms and levels which are far beyond my conception. But I think these questions need to be asked. I think it's important that we not take for granted concepts, but rather we understand them in the context of other concepts which are affected by what we take for granted. And I think it's important because it deals with the acceptance of what we are, which is, after all, the most important point. Because if somebody thinks that they could be more when they cannot, they have a false expectation, and they're causing themselves unnecessary anxiety. Yet at the same time, one who does have extra capacity and does aspire to more would naturally feel that way, that they should. So if one was to say, don't aspire to more because you can't get it, that would also be a mistake. The real problem is as soon as you say, do this, don't do that, you are placing in jeopardy the potential of complete manifestation of the being, because you don't know who you're dealing with. From this point of view, the only acceptable, shall we say, advice or pushing people in acceptable directions would be to say, be what you are. Understand it. Be aware of it. Be conscious of what you are and work with what you are. And for those who have such power and capacity, they can be two at once, for instance, then so be it. Or that would lend credence to, for example, God being everywhere at once, being all of us at once, but not at the same time. This makes the one and different a perfect concept. The one in the sense of that supreme. Let's use that concept. Being, manifesting all of us because of that capacity to do so. Yet once the manifestation has taken place, there is a difference as source and emanation, as one and different. And therefore you can look at the supreme and say, well, I am you. Yet that would be an incomplete statement, because you could look at another person and say, well, that person is also you. That person is also you. That living entity is also you. So we all have that identification. We all have that relationship. We all have that oneness. Yet we are unique in our own particular oneness. I know this is kind of, it's a complex yet necessary thing to talk about, because when we understand our power, we don't limit it. All that we are can be limited by our consciousness, because when we see a reason to limit, it becomes our desire to do so. And just because you aim towards a unity with the Supreme, try and understand this, does not mean you become the Supreme. It's not anything to worry about. It's a means by which the consciousness may strive for fullness, but you will always be what you are. You can be nothing else. I have been asked about those who take up the practice of identification with the Supreme, and they feel bad about it, yet at the same time, it helps them so much to expand themselves out of the box of being so insignificant. After all, if you are reaching so high, you will then reach beyond a self-inflicted barrier to your development. But you will not be able to go beyond what you are. You can only be what you are. Why should I worry? Why should I be upset when you are striving for that, let's say, great position? Because ultimately, you will come to what you are. Let's say the limits of what you are, if you need to hear it like that. But you will come to be what you are. So how could I be upset with that? Therefore, this idea of being the absolute greatest you can be, the absolute greatest version of that greatest vision you've ever had of yourself, this is an encouraging idea. It is not an idea which somehow or another insults God. It's an idea which brings you to the greatest thing you are, which can only please God. And if you think about it, it would be quite boring. Now, I'm taking liberties here in my words. But it would be quite boring for that Supreme to manifest these beings everywhere and insist on every one of them being exactly the same size. Just think about that. In the Isopanishad, we find that everything is a complete unit in itself. It does not say it's an exactly the same kind of unit, the exact same quantity of unit. It's a complete unit. That beingness, that's a complete unit, is a complete unit regardless of its relative dimension or power. People are people, whether they're big or small. Beings are beings, whether they're more or less powerful or more or less manifesting in a particular way. We do not have to make everybody the same. It is not even naturally a concept which makes perfect sense. And it frees us from this insane desire to expand our power, expand our influence, when indeed that's not what we should be doing. We should rather be discovering our being. Okay, if you want, discovering our limits, but discovering it, pushing the envelope of what we are to the point at which we are manifested what we are. As we are, sorry. So let's talk about that power. A being may be complete in itself with just a, relatively speaking, smaller, horrible word, I know, quantity, awful word, I know, but very perfectly a being in a smaller package. Now, I know these discussions are very troublesome because I'm going to right now challenge the whole concept that everybody's moving up. All the beings are moving through species of life. Because it may be, and I'm just opening it to discussion, it may be the beings are of different varieties, and the single-celled creatures are just that way, that kind of a power that manifests properly in that kind of a form. Now, I'm not saying there's no movement. I'm not saying there's no possibility to be in another form. I'm not saying that. However, I am questioning this absolute principle. You go from this little bitsy nothing to this human being through this, all these species and all this movement and all these millions and billions and trillions and gazillions of years. Admittedly, I became quite suspicious when reading about people who have used forms of regression to try to trace back lifetimes of people. And very rarely, if at all, was there a connection to some other kind of a form than a human being. Perhaps there was an extra, so-called extraterrestrial form at times, but very rarely, if at all, it just doesn't happen. This made me start to think, this made me start to question. And in my own understanding of how people go through lives when I do my own thing about this, I've also seen it the same way, that according to the being of the manifestation of form or of the manifestation of energy, according to the interaction, a form that relates with other forms is apparent. I mean, after all, if you think about it, let's say you take the example of the spiritual sky, you take Krishna Loka, whatever, Vrindavan. Well, you do have plants, you do have animals, you do have birds, you have all of these things. Now, do each of those have to go up to a conscious form like the human form to go down into a plant form there? That's so uncomfortable for a human being. I remember one Babaji told somebody who used to be in ISKCON, "You are a peacock in the spiritual sky." So he was trying to flap his wings and everything. I'm actually quite serious. And he was trying to get into the mood of being a peacock to experience the spirituality, but he was so frustrated because it was not his nature to be a peacock. Now, if you just let your mind wander over these issues and let your mind wander over the possibilities and the understanding and how you feel about things, you'll be able to better feel, shall we say, comfortable with what you are. Because after all, it's all you are. It's all you can be. And I don't mean all in a limiting way. It is a nice thing. It is a great thing to be what you are, because anything else is not that great thing. Now, okay, I've tried my best to amplify this point, and I know I've touched on I've mentioned things which are very touchy. I've perhaps entered into the realm of what somebody else might call blasphemy. I don't know. I'm just trying to analyze. I'm just trying to explain things from an unbiased point of view without having to accept something just because it should be accepted. Now let's make that very bold step of trying to figure out how, because remember from the lecture we dealt with the energy, the being, in the theoretical state of unencumbrance, how that would assemble energy as its form, and then we're talking about that form being just what it is, then what are we doing here? That's the next question. And then again, when we're in the in-between stage between lives and we have this awareness, we have this capacity, we have this expanded vision, why would we even choose to come back again? Why would we do it? These questions are very important to address. Many people find in this body of so-called New Age or new kind of literature or different alternative literature, it's very boring because we don't attempt to address motivation. We don't attempt to address desire. We don't attempt to address history. We don't attempt to address nature. But these points we cannot avoid because they are the essence of what we're interested in. Well, let's go back to the example of whoever you are, no matter who you are. When you are in this environment, you have to deal with it. You cannot avoid it. You cannot just kind of transcend it and float over it. Unless you are, for example, Vishnu, who comes on a swan airplane and comes from Vaikuntha down to bless a devotee, everybody has to interact. But I mean, even Vishnu is doing it because Vishnu comes from the spiritual world to interact with that devotee. That's an interaction. It's dealing with sound vibration. It's dealing with the history of that devotee. It's dealing with the destination and results of that devotee or some kind of benediction or blessing, like in Narada Muni's case. There is still a necessity of interaction. Now, you take any incarnation of God that has been described in any scripture anywhere throughout time. There is one theme which is constant throughout them. And that theme is the necessity to interact appropriately with environment, with the elements, with the people, with the history, with the politics, with the social framework. In other words, that totally free, absolutely powerful, unencumbered personality has to accept, like everyone else, a certain amount of encumbrance to be able to deal with reality. And you can't say there's not even any pain. You want to tell me Lord Ramachandra didn't feel pain when Sita was taken away? And if you just say it's his pastimes, actually he was ecstatic, that is really a cheap way to explain the crying, the wailing, the pain of Lord Ramachandra's emotion. The principle is, and nobody avoids this principle, when you are in a particular environment, you have to, must, you, there's no other way, you must interact with that environment according to certain principles which that environment exists within. And even if you have extraordinary power to overcome or to do things which are beyond the normal in that environment, you do it through the principle of manipulating energies within the environment, not being outside of it. Even if Brahma were to have created this universe, he would do it with elements of the universe, with energies of the universe, with powers within the universe. Maybe they are thousands and millions of times beyond anybody's present capacity to understand. But it would be within the integrated environment. It could not be anything else. So once you are here, you have to deal with it. It's no longer an option to not deal with it. Unless you do specifically things to place yourself in another kind of environment. And considering the nature of being and everything we said beforehand, when we are at the state of rest, in other words, just being, there is something which causes us to make a transition from the state of rest to a state of action, and that is some desire to do so. So we are here only because we want to be here. It is not necessarily a fact that we are here because we are envious of God. We are here because we want to be here. End of point. And our being here should not be seen in terms of mistake, regret, something we have to overcome. We should consider it in terms of a decision we made we thought was right at the time, according to the time we did it, according to our desire, like any other decision we make at any other point in time. So at the point we had the potential to make such a choice when such a desire arose, we felt it was in our best interests to do so. And like any other decision we've made that led us into any other consequence in our life, we can look back and say, ooh, that was a mistake. Or we could look back on it and say, you know, taken in the context of history, that was a very important part of my life for my overall growth. Let's say I did something yesterday which I really regret today. But let's say in a week from now I realize how important it was for that event to take place so that a transformation would happen. Now that transformation might be in terms of a growth, or it might simply be to remove a blockage of our energy so that our energy could flow in another way. Or that our capacity to experience, or the particular experiences we undergo, would able to come with us, would be able to achieve them. Therefore, there's no need to condemn yourself for being here. There's no need to condemn here for being here. Neither is there a need to therefore say, I'm here, I gotta get out of here. Here is here because I wanted to be here. I wanted to be here in here, and here exists because I wanted to be here. And I am here. If I want to get out, I go out. But there's no need for me to be hysterical about it. I can be what I am here, or I can be what I am there. It's a question of my consciousness. In other words, I'm trying to take all of these easy kind of labels, easy kind of concepts, to explain the existence, which always end up putting the blame on us. That's a very important point. It's not our fault. It is not a fault. It is not a defect. It is not something to beat ourselves over the head with. We've already got enough things in existence, enough people who will beat us over the head. We don't have to do it to ourselves. There are so many ways in which your so-called growth, that's a bad word and I'm going to explain that in a second, can manifest. It can also manifest through the way in which you are experiencing, the variety of the experience, the variety of the way in which your being can discover manifestations of itself. We usually think of growth in terms of, you know, we plant a seed and then it grows and then there's like 50 oranges. Or we have $5, it grows to $10, $15, $20, $100. Or we are, we know something in mathematics and we grow and we learn more and more knowledge and we get a degree. We think of growth like this, quantitative increase. But there's also growth of experience by having this experience, that experience, this experience. The qualities of the experiences are increasing or manifesting or whatever. That is another form of growth, and one which is much more compatible and in harmony with a being. And that kind of experience is something which is very compatible with beings and makes sense whether you are here or there or anywhere. Anyway, I just was trying very hard because I'm trying very hard to give another way of looking at the essential points within Eastern philosophy in general that doesn't have to be bogged down by points which could be not interpreted properly or could have been misrepresented by human beings. But I don't really care about whether this is right, that's right, the other's right. That's not the point. My point is to allow the full expression of our being, number one, and the full entrance into the experiences of that being, wherever they may arise. Now, again, you know, I know this is, there's questions flying up everywhere, and I admit I can't satisfy all of your inquiries, but I'm just trying to open the door to that opportunity you might have to feel good about yourself in the core of your heart for what you are. This will help you at every moment of life. This will help you at the moment of death. This will help you after death. This will help you every second of every minute of every hour of every moment of time, because it is what we are. And I have to admit, this has been the most exhausting discussion I have ever given in this more than 2 years now of broadcast. This is the most, for me, exhausting one, because I am reaching down into the very essence of my being to try to express this in a way which will resonate with you, with us, with me. I mean, it's easy to talk about this stuff if you're just repeating something you heard or something you're supposed to say, or something which, you know, is the accepted reality. But when you challenge it in any way, you really have to, it's a work. It's an effort to connect your being with that reality. Yet, when you are forced to reach into the depths of your consciousness, to express like this, it brings you there. Do you understand? It's easy to say something when you're not there saying it, and therefore it's hard to get there. But when you're there and you have to express it, and you're expressing it brings you there, that's the yoga. That was my point.